Hello there and welcome to Culture File with me, Luke Clancy, and this week's fluidly dynamic edition, which finds us worshipping some giant sturgeon at the Iron Gates, possibly worshipping definitely the music of Django Reinhardt in North Dublin, and in the end giving all due respect to the organ sounds of Sonic Chaos in the Mariendom in Linz. And we begin this time with the artist Barbara Knežević, whose latest exhibition centres on her film The Iron Gates, an uncanny encounter between the Mesolithic sculptures of Lipinski Vir and the place of the Balkans in the artist's own story, Niamh Daly reports.
These people seemingly lived there for 3,000 years or maybe more. There's some sense that they had a belief system that said that they had a finite number of souls in the world, and that by creating these sculptures they were acquiring souls from the animal world. There was something really beautiful about that idea to me, that sculpture could be capable of creating more souls or capturing souls from the animal world. My name's Barbara Knežević, and I'm an artist who works in sculpture and more recently in film. You know, I've always been interested in, I suppose, the power of objects and the power of human artistic endeavors to like describe a moment. I have been working in sculpture for most of my career, and I've always been interested in the agency of materials, the engagement of human beings with materials, and I suppose a belief in objects that human beings seem to have. And I've always worked with this sense of materials having some kind of agency or power over humans, or at least there being some kind of exchange of agency between humans and materials. I mean, we all experience this when we engage with the material world, that things won't do what we want them to do. You know, that they are only capable of doing certain things in relation to their, I suppose, material constitution. And when it comes to making sculpture, that's an even more heightened experience. So in the studio, I'll be using different materials, sort of wax, stone, jasmonite, steel, and many other things in between, sometimes plants. And what I mean when I say there's an exchange of agency, I mean, I'm not the only one imposing a will here. So like, I can't make a plant grow in any other way other than what it chooses to grow. And I worked with plants because they're a good example of this. You can feed them, you can water them, you can give them light, but beyond that, you know, they're sort of existing in a particular way, and it's no different with other things too. You know, stones will deteriorate in a particular way at a rate that's completely invisible to us or outside our timescales. But, you know, when I'm working with materials, those sorts of resistances to my will for them become more obvious.
Could we have a look? We're in your studio. What objects could we have a look at?
The pieces you're seeing here are versions of these sort of what I call like cores. You know, when we think about time, how do we expect time to be represented in objects? We often represent time in these sorts of geological cores that they take out of the ground. You know, you often see this in sort of glaciers or things like this. So that kind of representation of time in terms of like the earth is something I'm trying to like replicate in these sculptures here, which are a series of cast jasmonite. They're molded into PVC pipe and use pigments to sort of like differentiate different strata or layers, I suppose, and then begin to look like some form of like a geological experiment or something like that. This project, The Iron Gates, casts an eye back to ancient practices of living with objects, to what sculptural objects contribute to civilization and things like that. And I was researching, you know, ancient artifacts in particular, like Etruscan artifacts. And I was thinking, okay, so what predates that in Europe? I guess like Greek culture, you know, it's 2000 BC or so. Like how far back do things go? And then I began to look, and then I found these sculptures of Lipinski Vir. Mm-hmm. largely outside of Serbia, these objects are not really known about. They were found in the 1960s. A dam was being proposed by the government of Yugoslavia, and I guess they decided that, well, maybe it's worth a look. We don't want to sort of submerge when we flood the gorge. We don't want to like lose some archaeological discoveries. So they sent in Dragoslav Strejevic, who was this very famous archaeologist. They found the standard things. They found ceramic objects that they already knew about. And apparently on some kind of like whim, he was like, let's just go another bit further down. And then they uncovered this huge settlement that was completely unlike anything else, 10,000 years old. And it looks like they domesticated wolves. Like, there's so many interesting things. They were burying themselves cross-legged, sitting upright and facing upriver so that they could see the sturgeon fish return. They seem to be worshipping the gigantic sturgeons that were spawning outside their settlement.
And tell me about the sculptures, like what do they look like?
They're carved from river rocks. So they're made, the people were hauling these rocks out of the Danube, and the people of Lipinski Vir carved into them like hybrid fish humans. So it looks as though they were somehow honoring the fish and seeing themselves in relation to the animal world. And it, approximately 3 hours south of Belgrade on the Danube, is the actual archaeological site. So the site itself is preserved, but the objects themselves are replicas of the sculptures. They're not the real ones. They're replicas that are there to demonstrate where they were placed and where they're originally found. They're all fakes. So that was kind of, I'm crushingly disappointed by that. But then I was like, no, this is even more interesting. So in the end, this became a little bit of a narrative point in the film, where there are five characters that are voiced in the film. All of them are non-human. So one of them is one of the sculptures, and her name is Voda Navila, which means water fairy. So the sculpture appears in the film, but she's desiring to go home, and she says she wants to return.
In the film, there's a shot of very carefully moving the sculpture. So is it the real one, or is it the remake?
That's the real one. And actually, that was about 10 minutes before that shot was the first time I ever saw Voda Navila. And she is my favorite. And I was with Bojana, who is the curator of the collection. She got my genuine, like, obsession with this. She understands it because she has it too. And so we went over to these boxes as the museum staff wheeled them in on these carts, and we opened that box and we saw Voda Navila for first time. And yeah, it was quite overwhelming, because this is such a privilege, actually. That was what my overriding feeling was, that I get to even see it, because no one is seeing them. And then, you know, getting to film it. I mean, as a person and as an artist, these moments are like unforgettable.
Barbara Knežević there, talking to Niamh Daly. And The Iron Gates is now at the Sirius until the end of November. And from the Danube to the Tolka next, Stephen Daly is a questing Dublin musician, fired up by music from the East as much as the West. He's played with the North Strand Klezmer Band and recently released an album with Tolka Hot Club, perfumed with the gypsy jazz of one hero, Django Reinhardt, as he told Louis Scully.
My name is Stephen Daly, born in Dublin, grew up over kind of the Finglas East, Glasnevin North, contested area. Played a guitar, gypsy jazz style guitar. I play the fiddle, music predominantly from, I suppose, the Balkans, and I play Irish traditional music as well. And I also play the Cretan lyre, which is an old bowed instrument from the Ottoman Empire. It's a completely different technique. You make contact with the fingernail. So you're kind of flicking out and pressing with the fingers rather than pushing. I I usually will dig out something that I want to learn and I'll try and slow it down. And then I'll happily sit there for hours or days or weeks with just pieces and pieces and just learn them until I'm playing, it's mimicry really, till I'm mimicking exactly what I'm hearing. That's my world, that's where I escape. I love learning instruments, I love trying to sit down and learn tunes. One of the things I really like about music is personality. So if someone can transmit their sound or their personality into the sound they're making, that's what kind of gets its claws into me. I learned a bit about Django Reinhardt and the fact that he was playing with two fingers, which I initially thought, like, that's a joke. There's no way anyone's playing that stuff with two fingers. Did a bit of research. I saw it was true. He had burnt a lot of his body in a fire and he lost the use of the second two fingers on his left hand. So he kind of had to readapt the entire approach and style that he played. I mean, that just blew my mind. I played a lot with the North Strand Contraband. It started out as the North Strand Klezmer Band. And initially when we started, Daniel Page, who is the clarinet player, was learning a lot of the klezmer repertoire, which is fairly closely, you know, it goes really hand in hand with a lot of Romanian, Bulgarian music that you wouldn't call klezmer. He was learning a lot of that, and I remember having a discussion about it at the time because we all didn't want to really pigeonhole ourselves. We changed our name, the lineup changed a little bit as well. We brought in drums. It progressed into not just, you know, klezmer pieces anymore, and they became more of the deeper music that you'd find Ivo Papazov doing. Can't pronounce a lot of the guys that I'm interested in names, but a lot of the people from those regions, we started doing a lot of their kind of music, but doing it with our own arrangements and with the instruments that we have. You know, obviously a cymbalum is a big part of music that you find in Romania and Hungary. It's no cymbalum in Ireland. So we arranged them for the instruments that we had, and I suppose we had our own little sound. We played everywhere and anywhere. I think I probably played in every venue possible in this country at the time. By around 2014, it was hard to get us all together again. So that's when obviously there was a bit of a lull for me, and myself and Dave were always chipping away with the Gypsy Jazz and the Django Reinhardt stuff. And in around 2015, 2016, we kind of decided to get a bit more serious about that style and try and form a little group. And that was the birth of the Talk of Hot Club. So I suppose there is a bit of a link really, but yeah, two different chapters. We started out doing a lot of the classic Gypsy Jazz repertoire, and then I started bringing the violin, kind of going between the guitar and the violin, and then we've been doing a couple of Eastern European, a couple of Balkan numbers, and on the album actually I have to say we've got three originals. One is written by myself, one is written by Ken Whelan, the accordion player, and one is written by Dave. First one is a waltz. It's an instrumental piece. It's very beautiful. The tune Dave wrote is called The Last Time. That's kind of got more of an Americana kind of feel to it. And then the one that I wrote is called Chasing Vikings. Fascinated with history as well as music, and at the time when I was putting that tune together, I was doing a lot of reading about the Battle of Clontarf, and one of the last places that the Vikings, when they were getting chased out of Dublin, they got chased over the River Talca down by where Lough Kelly Bridge is now and out into the Bay of Clontarf. on my usual hunt for obscure little gems. There's a lot of gramophone kind of sites online, a lot of piano roll sites as well, which they're not strictly gypsy jazz, but it's all around the same area and it can all be worked into that style. I actually believe they got some of the really famous pianists at the time, like Gershwin. I think even Rachmaninoff might have done one or two of them. But they got these guys in to play. They would play and punch holes in these rolls. Those rolls would then be used. They'd be kind of configured or put into a piano. Then the piano would play these rolls and play the keys. But yeah, I believe they got them so accurate that if you weren't looking at the piano playing itself, you could actually be fooled into thinking Gershwin was sitting there playing. These were really, really, really popular. They were everywhere. If you owned a bar or a pub and you didn't have to pay a piano player all the time, you had a piano roll. That could have been a cost-saving thing at the time. A lot of the piano rolls you'll find will tend to be kind of rags or ragtime music, but there's a lot of classical stuff up there as well. The people who played into them, a lot of them would be lost to time, but I do remember reading that they did actually get well-known names to come in and record for these piano rolls. I mean, I'm nearly sure I heard somewhere that Rachmaninoff might have done one. I think Gershwin might have played a couple of them. You get a lot of people who find these and they'll digitize the collections, they'll archive them. So you can go and you can look for them and you can find them and you can download them. And what they're essentially doing is uploading stuff that would have been lost to history. And hopefully more will be found before it's too late and put up for people like me.
Stephen Daly there, and the album Tolka Hot Club is available via Bandcamp. And finally this time, the indeterminate creativity of the universe itself. Navid Navab and Garnet Willis took the gold prize at this year's Ars Electronica in Austria for the latest iteration of their organism platform, built around a collection of organ pipes salvaged from a Montreal church and existing as an installation, an instrument, a performance and a worldview. Organism aims for nothing less than an escape from the prison of notes. As Navab and Willis explained to me, the captain has now switched on the seatbelt sign as we may experience periods of turbulence.
My name is Garnet Willis. I'm an artist, and I love to build beautiful, exciting, surprising machines.
I'm Navid Navab, and I've been working at the intersection of art, science, music, and phenomenology of performance for over a decade, creating works that bring lively qualities of materials to the senses, sometimes in sound, but also through all senses.
What we've been trying to do is to produce a kind of organ that is exactly not the church organ. Although the pipes come from a church historically, if you look at any one pipe, the majority of the sounds that pipe can produce are not the sounds the church wants. They were very regulated, everything was controlled, so that their pipe sound in the church organ, absolutely pure sine tones, it's in tune. It's not messy, it's been tidied up. And in our organ, we look for any sound that isn't that tidy sound.
When you encounter the exhibit version, Organism and Excitable Chaos, you will see a chaotic triple pendulum, simplest nonlinear dynamical system that exists as a movement system, where through the exchange of potential and kinetic energy between three arms, you have emergent patterns that are chaotic, unpredictable, exhibiting the three-body problem, but for us there is the three-body no problem, because what's at stake is the creativity of the universe itself that's indeterminate. So what you encounter is this musical unfolding of chaotic cosmos turning into sound through the organism, which itself has a turbulent ecological sonic behavior. So there's two alive systems in conversation with one another. The conceptual framework around organism was an organ media archaeologically reimagined to sound the turbulence of nature that through European colonization of indigenous musical cultures were dampened. The second oldest church in Montreal goes through a rapid process of gentrification, hyper-commercial gentrification. So the bottom became a gym, upstairs became a rave and wedding venue. So then there was a billionaire buying the building, renting it to a millionaire, and we're like, hey, can we take those pipes? This happened to be Cassavan organ pipes from 1910. They're gorgeous. And they were disrespected, smashed into pieces, beer bottles in the belly of the organ. And they realized the restoration was so expensive that they allowed us to go in and retrieve the pipes. So then I was surrounded by three trucks worth of organs. There's the source of air, but there's the behavior of air in terms of its energetic behavior, which becomes the agency of the organ, which had been made dormant in the service of Western 12-tone ideology. However, if one were to zoom in into the physics, the very non-linear, wacky, dissipative physics of flue pipes in organs. So now, applying principles of structured improvisations from traditions such as music actuelle and free jazz that has a bit of structure, instead of working with human relations in terms of musicality, we put the pipes into an energetic relationality with one another, where the push and pull of air into one pipe pulls from the other. Times 60 pipes, you get an ecology of interdependent timbres. So each macro composition is this metastable energetic environment that then within which has distinct characteristics that as a performer is like an alive agency, a wave that I surf upon.
Even with a stabilized pipe, in order for it to generate its stabilized sound, the boring sound that he was talking about, some people like it, it still requires the turbulence.
Yes.
Like, but then the church organ designer controls that turbulence right away. Right, our thing is, okay, let's let this chaotic turbulence rule, right? And we work as hard as we can to unleash as many timbres out of each pipe that we can.
One would think that organs is just pipe and air, but there's a universe of liveliness that's been dampened. When the laminar flow incoming into the flute pipe hits the edge of the flute, it curves onto itself and we get vortex jetting phenomena that's responsible for the eerie sound of Aeolian harps. And then the resonator becomes a curator for the shed vortices. In traditional organ, the incoming energy of the flow of air has been stabilized so the most prominent shed vortex matches the resonant frequency of the resonator, yielding a very hyper-stabilized, thus dead, tone.
Like some people call it nice.
So what we freed over four prototypes, because it was no easy task, was this alive, psychedelic, noise-enfolding temporality of the energetic, energetically produced sound. And we try to work with that. So this is what we meant by saying prepared organ. However, if you push the energetic state of a pipe by, let's say, overblowing it or applying more air pressure, it does something called edge tone jumping. This is a seemingly simple phenomenon. When a pipe yodels and goes woo-woo, or jumps by a seventh or an octave, what you have is a discontinuous, spontaneous jump in behavior from the perspective of the vortices that are shed that reorganize themselves on a higher level. So this is a classic hallmark of nonlinear dissipative systems phase shifting.
I was thinking at the performance, oh, this is jazz. It's like free jazz is kind of a bop thing happening. Is that something that emerges naturally from the physics that you're discovering there?
This is a really cool question because it took 4 years to answer. Because what happened is we removed notes, no notes, zero notes. We just thought energy, liveliness, sights of eeriness, push and pull of air, stay in the moment, listen, respond. What emerged from audience's response was references to very, very specific musical cultures, from Japanese gagaku to polyrhythmic flutes in certain parts of South America and Africa. Even klezmer came up, Persian Sufi Ney, micro-glitch techno, post-rock. So I was like, what the fuck is happening?
Does that depend on who the audience is?
Exactly. Yes, but then this was the first, but that's why it took 4 years to understand what's happening conceptually deeply. So one could say control over nature's turbulence, at least in this case in the technologies of sonic formation, is the process in which nature becomes cultural. So this is called the becoming cultural of nature. So instead of working with in a nature that has already became cultural within a specific culture like 12-tone ideology and etc., we've set this process free. So then cultures of musicking emerge in situ in the moment of performance. And what is true improvisation? As Malcolm Goldstein, a Montreal Music Actual Performance, says, improvisation means existing in the moment, for the audience included, to discover something about the nature of something unfolding. So our hope is for the audience to really think about this. I was like, why is this happening? Where is nature? What is culture? Where is the line? Where is music? Where is noise?
It's not really like an artwork, in that artwork means art, artifice, right? Most artworks symbolize something, right? A painting of a scene, a sculpture of a something. This is a thing unto itself. What does it symbolize? Its own natural tendency to produce generative and exciting outcomes. So I think audiences, because of the way that we are porous as human beings and the way that we relate to the world of nature, we're presented with here a piece of technology that is doing what nature normally does.
Naveed Nawab and Garnet Willis there, remaking the organ. And that's almost it for this time. If you haven't yet grabbed your ticket to our Culture File debate sessions next Saturday, November 8th at the National Botanic Gardens as part of Dublin Book Festival, now's the time. Paddy Woodworth is in the chair at 1 p.m. for a session on the philosophy of the Hare's Corner with music from Colin McInimra. And directly afterwards, I'm helping a panel decide, do bugs need a glow-up? DublinBookFestival.com for bookings. See you there.